Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is David Allen Sibley. What it's like to be a bird, from flying to nesting, eating to singing, what birds are doing and why. Birds entrance us. Flight, song, beauty, migration, unanimity, and more prosaically, their eyesight, their ability to perceive more of the electromagnetic spectrum than us, even the ability to sense the Earth's magnetic field. Color, plumage, the structure of a feather, and its myriad of purpose, the purpose of song, attraction between two individuals, the force that drives procreation, and the reason we're here today. A recapitulation of the genius behind natural selection. So with that, welcome, David, and thanks so much for joining us today. So at the beginning, before we get into the book itself, let's talk a little bit about how the two of us got here today. Your father, your childhood, your mentor, so to speak, and as have you've said in interviews, these are the men on whose shoulders you have actually stood. Well, figuratively stood.
Yeah. Well, yeah, my father's an ornithologist, so I grew up in a house with birds, bird books, bird study, that obviously had a big influence, but I always liked birds and liked drawing, and those two things go together really well. Drawing is a great way to study birds, so I learned a lot as I drew, and my drawings got better, but I grew up birding with my father, with his colleagues, local bird clubs, and we moved to Connecticut when I was 10 years old, and Roger Torrey Peterson, who wrote the first field guide and a big series of really influential field guides to all aspects of nature, he lived about 20 miles away from us in Connecticut, and I got to meet him a few times and show him some of my drawings, and he was very encouraging and helpful. And I think the biggest influence that he had was just his existence, his presence, the fact that there was someone who had made a living writing field guides. And as I grew up, birding, being surrounded by people who were interested in birds and watching birds and using field guides, with Roger not far away, making a living writing field guides, it seemed to me that was a pretty normal career path, something that people do. So I grew up with the dream, you know, my goal, even as a teenager, was someday to write and illustrate my own field guide. And I just set out on a path to do that. It really does. It's building, obviously, on all of the work that came before.
Talk about, you know, when you're talking about your beginnings, you started keeping a life book. And most people have no idea what that is. And I don't know why it's called that. Talk a little bit about what a life book is.
Oh, I think a life list.
Yeah,
a list. It's a list of all the species of birds that you've seen, and birders. Birding is sort of the one fundamental aspect of it is identifying species and keeping track of the species that you've seen. And it's a really fun and rewarding way to sort of organize your hobby and keep track is to keep a list of all the birds that you've seen in your life, anywhere in the world. But people also keep lists of what species they've seen in their home state, in their yard, during each calendar year, and lots of other little variations. So these lists become really important. It's a great way to keep track, to compare your experience with other birders, but also as an incentive to get out and look for something new, to track down those few species that you still need, that you still haven't found. So that sort of list keeping is a big aspect of a big part of birding, and makes it really fun. And like I said, I think one of the biggest aspects of listing is just as an incentive. It's a great way to say, all right, now it's mid-April. These species should be migrating north, and this is my chance now to get out and find one for this year, or I'm going to go search for one in this county where I've never seen one before. So those kinds of things really kind of push you to get out and look for new things in new places.
Well, do you have you must have started this life list when you were very young. So what do you have? Do you have book after book after book? Have you transferred all this information to a computer? And I just wonder how you keep the comprehensive data that you've collected over your entire life.
Yeah, people keep their lists in different ways. Nowadays, many people keep their lists digitally. In a computer database, there's a few different options for that. I actually honestly don't keep very careful track of my life list anymore. As I travel to different places, it's exciting to see new birds and travel to new countries, new places, and I'm definitely adding birds to my life list, but I haven't really kept careful track of it.
You've seen pretty much everything, so you don't need to anymore. It's interesting, when I was researching this, I can't remember the scientific name, but one of the birds that you have, they say are very difficult to find, which are in, I don't understand, this plume of water in the ocean. Can you explain that? I have no idea what it is.
That may be maybe talking about a bird called whiskered auklet that is found in the central Aleutians. And it was the last North American nesting species that I added to my life list. It was the last breeding species that I illustrated in the book that I hadn't seen. And I managed to get there. It's just very difficult to get to the areas where they are. They're found in the central Aleutians, which are almost uninhabited. There's very little development, very little access. And then once you get to the islands, you have to get on a boat and get out into the strong tidal currents that flow in between the islands. That's where these birds actually spend their days feeding. So you have to get out into these at least a few miles offshore or more, and into these strong currents that are rushing back and forth through the relatively narrow passes between the islands. So that's a really difficult bird to get to with a limited range. And that's an example of one that, it's a fascinating area, a really exciting, wild and kind of relatively unexplored part of the world. And I wouldn't have ever gone there if not for the desire to see a whiskered auklet.
I never thought of birding as being a dangerous occupation, but it sounds from the way you're talking that I guess it is. You've been to so many places and so many remote places that, yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it dangerous exactly, but you can pursue it at that level where it takes you to really out of the way, remote places that require a lot of planning, travel logistics, and physical effort often to actually get to the places. So, and there are people who do much more extreme sort of wilderness birding than I do. If you let it take you to that level, it's definitely a kind of pioneering wilderness travel experience.
How much of your time do you spend doing this? Traveling, that is.
Nowadays, not so much. I did, when I was working on the book in the 1980s and early 90s, when I was traveling, doing the research and learning about the birds before I did all the paintings for the field guide, I was traveling around North America almost full time, living in a camper van and just driving back and forth across the continent, going to different places and seeking out all the birds at different seasons in different places. So that was pretty much full-time travel for about 10 years. Since then, I've been more sedentary, still traveling quite a bit, but just sort of one-week, two-week trips, and spending most of my time in the studio painting and writing.
What was the first bird that you put into your life list?
I was 7 years old, and I went out on a hike with my father in Southern California, where we were living at the time, and we saw a great horned owl, which is a big owl, the biggest owl that most people would encounter in the United States. And so I knew enough about birds already. I had been, you know, drawing birds and noticing birds. I knew enough about them to know that seeing this great horned owl was a special experience. And that was the bird that prompted me to start keeping a life list. So I think I saw about 20 species of birds that day. But my life list started with 20 species that day.
Wow.
Great horned owl was really the spark, the one that I thought in my 7-year-old brain was, that's worth having on a life list.
Well, it's interesting because there's so many beautiful illustrations that you've done in this book and in all your books. So what a wonderful coincidence that not only have you been able to do all of this, but when did you begin realizing that you also had the talent to draw these birds? And do you draw them from memory? Do you draw them from photographs? Do you draw them as you see them? How do you do that?
Yeah, I've been drawing birds since as long as I can remember. I always, you know, from the time I could hold a pencil or a crayon, I liked drawing, and birds were my favorite subject. And with, you know, all the opportunities that my father could offer as an ornithologist, the opportunities to see birds, to see them up close, to learn about them, any question that I had could be answered. And so they just became more and more important to me. And it was just lots of practice, I just enjoyed drawing them, and the more I drew them, the better I got. And I think even as a teenager, I was thinking about that someday I could write a field guide and do all these illustrations. And it didn't really become real until I was about in my late 20s. That's when, after I had been traveling for a long time and really studying all the birds and sketching in the field, I felt like I knew the birds well enough then to be able to take on the project of illustrating a field guide. But it was a few more years before I really started working on it. So most of my time was, most of my drawing experience was in the field, watching the birds in real life and doing pencil sketches. That was where I learned a lot about them, about shapes, the patterns, and how to represent that on paper. And then for the paintings that are in the book, those are all done in the studio. So that's after I've done all the traveling and sketching, studying in the field, I get back into the studio. And years later, looking at my sketches, looking at photographs, a lot of other reference material, and compiling all of that into the paintings that appear in the book.
So what do you do when you're looking at birds or searching for them at a distance? I assume, as I've seen videos of people who are looking for birds, that they use binoculars. And I wondered if you started using them and what kind you used or changed over the years, or if you don't use them.
Oh, yeah, I definitely use binoculars. They're really essential part of bird watching. They bring the birds, you know, typically birders use 7-power to 10-power binoculars, so essentially bringing the birds 7 to 10 times closer, and you can really see a lot of details. And I also often use a telescope, which is even more powerful, so I use a 30-power telescope, so that can make a bird that's 300 feet away seem like it's 10 feet away. So you see a lot of detail, and that's really critical for drawing, especially to be able to see the details and interpret those for a drawing. So binoculars have changed a lot in my lifetime. When I started out, the binoculars were honestly pretty low quality. Optics, the manufacturer of optics was not anywhere near as good as it is now. So I started out using binoculars that would be really hard to imagine now. Even the relatively low-priced binoculars that you can buy now, like $100 to $300 range, are so much better than what I was using in the 1970s. So there are lots of binoculars now that are designed and manufactured specifically for bird watching that have features like being able to focus down to really close distances. They work with eyeglasses, other things, a wide field of view, all these things that make using them for bird watching much easier.
So if we get into, which I guess our readers are most interested in, would be some of the ways you describe aspects of birds that are different between different species. And since you mentioned the great horned owl, talk a little bit about sight and why, for example, the great horned owl has eyes that require it to also, by natural selection, allow its head to turn, you know, 180 or even more degrees.
Yeah. So that's some of the stuff that's in my new book, What It's Like to Be a Bird. And I started researching all these things, learning about the birds, and was just amazed at how many things I didn't know. Even after a lifetime of bird watching, I learned so much working on this book, and there's so many things, everything is connected. So, you know, everyone, if you look at an owl, you notice that the eyes are on the front of the head, not the sides, like other birds. So owls are seeing what's in front of them, like us. But one of the things that follows from that is that they're not seeing what's behind them or to the sides, so they have to be able to turn their head often and easily. So owls can their neck is incredibly flexible. They can turn their head three quarters of a circle, like not quite all the way around, like the folklore says. They can't spin their head completely around in a circle, but they can go three quarters of the way around. And they have some really specialized adaptations in their neck to be able to do that. And also, since they hunt a lot by hearing, they have to be able to hear clearly. And their feathers have a lot of adaptations to make them, to make any movement silent. So their feathers have a soft sort of velvety surface. So as the feathers slide across each other when the head spins, they don't make any sound. So the owl can sit on its perch and be hearing things around it and spinning its head around. But even as it spins its head, its feathers are making no sound, nothing that interferes with their ability to hear what's around them.
So, yes, feathers, which play a really integral part in the book because there's so much that they do. Let's go through some of those. Actually, let's start with something that most 95% of readers are not going to know, that birds are dinosaurs. That's something that most people have no idea. So talk about that and how feathers weren't really feathers and then what they became and what they're useful for.
Yeah, there's been, the connection between birds and dinosaurs has been debated for a long time. The idea, I think it first came up in the late 1800s, the possibility that birds and dinosaurs were related. But it's just recently that enough fossils have been found and enough different facts have been pulled together to make it very clear that yes, birds are the direct descendants of dinosaurs. And there, a lot of dinosaurs had feathers, or the sort of proto-feathers, the early stages of feathers, even 160 million years ago. And the first feathers were hollow bristles, like just a tube, a long straight tube with that would have been useful for insulation. It could have been, those could have been colored for camouflage or for display. But dinosaurs, some of the earliest sort of feathered dinosaurs, had these hollow bristles all over their bodies. And those gradually evolved from that into a like the fibers that formed this hollow bristle could split and separate into a downy, fluffy arrangement. And then the next stage of feather development is a central shaft, which branches into fluffy plumes coming off the side, like an ostrich feather. And then they developed more specialization to allow those little side plumes to stick together to form the more solid surface of the modern feather. But those had developed even while they were still dinosaurs. And all the dinosaurs were wiped out then by the meteor that struck in the Yucatan about 65 million years ago, that changed life on Earth so dramatically that it wiped out all of the dinosaurs and they think all but about three species of birds.
Wow.
So all the birds that we see today are evolved from those three species that survived the asteroid collision 65 million years ago.
Yeah, I always wondered about that because I thought of the cold-blooded aspect of dinosaurs and the fact that, yeah, I didn't think that anything survived.
Yeah. But,
So as to feathers, there's so much about it, but here's one in particular that I had no idea about, that preening actually produces a waxy substance that increases the waterproof aspect of feathers. I mean, that's just a tiny thing that you talk about, but I had no idea that. And where does that originate?
Yeah, well, the birds have a gland near the base of their tail that produces a sort of waxy oil. And they use that. If you watch a bird preening, you'll see that it's constantly going back to the feathers just above the base of the tail and rubbing its bill and its head against that spot. That's where this oil is produced. And then it can rub that oil all over its feathers. And the oil, it helps with feather conditioning, and it helps a little bit with water repellency, but the feathers are actually waterproof because of their structure. The arrangement of the barbs in the feather prevents water from going through the feather or sticking to the surface of the feather. So a feather with none of the preen oil on it at all is still waterproof and water repellent, sort of like Gore-Tex. It's the spaces between the barbs on the feather are too small for water to flow through. So a drop of water, because of the surface tension, the drop of water holds together in a droplet too large to go through the gaps in the feather. So it just sits on the surface and rolls off. But that's because of the structure of the feather, not just because of the oil that they preen on.
You talk a lot about, at least in the outset, about natural selection and attraction between birds because of the plumage and things like that. So if you go, say, to a Darwin again and the Galapagos and the various species of finches that he was able to observe from island to island, is that all? Well, I know it's natural selection, but it seems so amazing. How do those things occur incrementally? And what are the differences, and how do those differences benefit a species that's so closely locationally existing?
Yeah. Well, that so natural selection is all about survival, and so if you imagine two species of, or let's say one population of finches on an island, and if there's some shortage of food, some other event that puts some stress on the population, there's always some level of variation within the population. There's going to be variation. Some birds have larger bills, some have smaller bills, and say some event happens, some shortage of food, and the individuals that survive happen to be the ones with larger bills that were able to switch to a different food source or take advantage of some food that was still available during this crisis. So suddenly the population, the variation in the population has shifted to mostly large-billed birds, and they reproduce, and their offspring would tend to have large bills because there's a genetic basis to that bill size. And over time, those tiny incremental changes lead to the entire diversity of life on Earth, just because one population, some members of a population are slightly better adapted, have an advantage in some situation, and produce more offspring and pass on that variation to their offspring. And over time, over many generations, a species changes.
Are you still amazed by that sometime after all this? I mean, like when I get on an airplane and it flies, there's part of me that says, how is this possible? How can this possibly happen? Do you still have that sense of wonder even after all this time?
Yeah, absolutely. It's hard to comprehend how all of this diversity could have developed just through that simple process. But it's millions and millions of generations that have produced all this diversity. And one of the things that I've been realizing, there's more and more studies now in the last 10 or 20 years that show that some pretty significant changes, measurable changes, can happen in a very short period of time. So there's several studies that show that the overall size of many species of birds, sort of the average size across the species, has changed by 2 or 3% just in the last 50 years. And it's being attributed to a changing climate, that size being larger or smaller is better adapted in some situations, so that the larger or smaller members of a species are doing better and producing more offspring, and gradually the overall size is changing. But it's happening in the last 50 years, just in during the time that really intensive study and measurements of birds has been going on. So these, as I was starting out learning about birds, I kind of imagining that those kinds of differences, a difference of a few percent in the size of of populations, was something that took hundreds or thousands of years or more to evolve, but it's not. It happens very quickly.
Well, because of that, going to another subject that you speak a lot about and people may think about to a certain extent is song, bird song. I mean, to be as simple as possible, I have two parakeets, and I can kind of tell when they're happy, and I can kind of tell when they're angry or upset or fearful. And I've read a little bit about it because I was curious. But you talk a lot about song and what it means and how much of it is actual communication. Talk a little bit about that, because that's a big part of your book.
Yeah. Well, bird song is, just from a functional perspective, it's the way typically a male sings to claim a territory. So he's advertising, telling other males that he's claiming this territory, and telling females that he's available, that he's got a territory, he's ready, he's looking for a mate. That's the function of song, but the details of what it means and how it's, I think one of the most interesting things is how it's practiced. One of the things I learned is that there's research that shows that birds practice their songs, and when they think they don't have an audience, when they're singing just for themselves, a sort of practice session, they sing in a more casual way. They're not as precise. They drop parts of the song. The pitch varies more. And then when they're actually in front of an audience, when they know that they're singing for a specific audience, there's a female nearby or another male, their song gets much more precise and loud. And it's I make the comparison in the book that a bird's song is kind of like almost like a gymnastics performance, that they're going for precision and speed and range of pitch from low to high. They want to be able to sing these different elements of the song with a wide pitch range, but sing them rapidly and precisely so that every song that they sing sounds exactly like the one before. And that's how they're being judged by their rivals or their potential mates. So it's kind of like watching a gymnastics performance where you're looking for rapid spins and flips and jumps that are also very precise and performed the same way, with no fumbles, no mistakes, no a perfect landing every time. That's the kind of information that the bird is sending in its song, that it's physically able to produce these sounds in this very precise and demanding way.
Well, you talked a little bit about how song deals with attraction. Talk a little bit more about, it's like with human beings when we began to evolve. Males searched for women who had lustrous hair, nice skin and red lips and all these things, and that was in order to create a more successful genetic pool. So talk a little bit about, say, in addition to the song, talk a little bit about plumage and coloration and how that attracts. And then also, I don't quite understand what's a woman, what's a girl looking for in a bird.
Yeah, that's just the concept of beauty, which is in the eye of the beholder. It's an idea. I mean, Darwin, I think, was the first one to put this idea forward that a lot of evolution could be just the preferences of mates, of its of sexual selection, that just the mating preferences of the species, depending on what is attractive to the opposite sex, determines which individuals will reproduce. And that leads to a lot of the more colorful, more extravagant displays and the more elaborate songs. All of that is one bird trying to, or being more beautiful than the next. And then attracting a mate and being able to reproduce. So birds really, exquisitely plumaged birds like the male wood duck, that is probably just the result of the females choosing mates over millions of generations, and choosing a mate that will stand out, or that choosing a male that stands out from the flock, choosing the brightest, most extravagantly plumaged male of the group, and gradually those features are passed on and become even more extreme. And it works because the female's offspring, if her offspring will inherit the features of the male that she chooses to mate with, and also inherit her own preferences for what's beautiful. So the system is kind of self-perpetuating, that the concept of beauty and the beautiful birds go hand in hand. And it's great that we perceive them as beautiful also.
I know. And that would, actually, that's a good segue to my next question, which is why do some birds, and specifically, say, pigeons, why do they decide over eons that they want to hang out with us, that they want to be where we are?
Yeah, that's a few species of birds have adapted to live alongside humans. And there's one really, really interesting case of the house sparrow, which is the common sparrow in cities all over the world. If you see sparrows hopping around under a park bench, they're likely to be house sparrows. They're native to Europe and Asia. And the researchers have been able to trace the genetics back to one group of house sparrows about 10,000 years ago in the Middle East. When human agriculture began, these house sparrows adapted to take advantage of all the extra food that was being grown by humans. So the grain that's being grown by humans is larger seeds, tougher seeds, and more starch. So the birds had to adapt to live on that with slightly larger bills and the ability to digest the starch. But that group of house sparrows that evolved, that were able to make the leap to adapt to eating the grain that was being grown by humans, have now spread along with human agriculture all over the world. And they, wherever they find their way across the ocean and make a foothold on a new continent, they just have exploded. They were introduced in New York City. Some were brought from England to New York City in the mid-1800s. And by the early 1900s, they were found from coast to coast in the United States. They just managed to find a way to take advantage of the new habitat, the new system that humans have created. And most species of birds don't do that. They're living in natural habitat, eating natural food, and they don't coexist so well with humans. But a few species have made that leap.
It's interesting because there's kind of a corollary thing, and I was thinking about this right before. I was thinking, how do we feel about birds? And then I was thinking back to the ancient Egyptians. And if you look at a wall of hieroglyphics, birds appear so many times. What was it that they, if this is out kind of out of your bailiwick, but what is it about that? What is it about birds that made us feel that they were something special? And starting with the Egyptians, for example.
Yeah, birds have always had a special place in human art and culture. It's I think one of the fundamental things that makes that happen is that birds communicate with each other through sight and sound the same way we do, which makes them visible and audible and constantly present. So they're mammals communicate a lot by smell. Any other kind of living thing, any other class of living things is communicating by methods that we can't really connect with. But birds, almost all of their communication is by sight and by sound. So we can connect with them better. We can get a better understanding of what they're doing, what they're saying to each other, what they're up to. And then you have this sort of mysterious, magical aspect of flight and migration, that they come and go, they mark the seasons. They're there one day and gone the next. It's so they have that sort of mystical quality I think those things are really at the base of the why birds have appealed to humans forever.
Yeah, and also there's this admiration and fantasy about the fact that for so long you look at a bird and you realize it's flying, and it's always been like, I wish I could fly. And yeah. So there's always been that about it too.
Yeah.
I can remember that from when I was a child.
Yeah. Yeah. Watching a bird soaring around on the wind, just riding the updrafts, is just such a wistful thing. Everyone wishes we could do that.
It's like at my house, I live out in the country, and right now on my pond are wood ducks, but we also have red-tailed hawks. And when you just watch them, it's just like such a beautiful thing to watch. And you, the first thing you think, at least I think, is I wish I could do that.
Yeah.
You know, and I guess that's part of why you, I mean, maybe it is part of the reason you started. I don't know exactly what attracted you to it, other than, you know, I know that it's in your family, and I know that you, were so close to famous people about it. But yeah, wasn't that one of the things that maybe had something to do with it?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Watching birds fly is such a, that's such a great experience. And the fact that birds, you know, when you go bird watching, you never know what you're going to see. Even when you step out into your yard or look out your kitchen window at the backyard, you don't know what birds are going to be there. So there's that quality of excitement and sort of the ever-changing treasure hunt of bird watching, that every time you go out in search of a species, you can't be sure you're going to find it. So it's always kind of magical and really a treat when you do find it. So I think that aspect of bird watching is the thing that really hooked me as a kid, that excitement of not knowing what you're going to find and the potential of finding something that would be really exciting.
Yeah. I mean, we haven't even talked about hummingbirds, but when I watch them, it's just like, I can't believe that there's a creature that exists that has a metabolism like that. There's just, how many species of hummingbirds are there?
I think there are about 350 species in the world, but almost all of them are in South America. They're only found in North and South America, none in the Old World. And there are about a dozen species that occur regularly north of Mexico into the U.S., but only a few species that get up north to Canada. But as you go south, the diversity just skyrockets. There's hundreds of species in South America.
So one last question, David, although there's tons of questions I could ask about this book. What is happening, if anything, to the ecosystem in which many of these birds live because of human beings, whether it be climate change or the decimation of the rainforest, stuff like that?
Yeah, it's, you know, you'll hear a lot of alarming, depressing, discouraging news about all of that everything is changing in our lifetimes. It's the climate is changing, habitats are changing. And the birds that we see now are the birds that have adapted, that have managed to find a way to persist in this environment. So a lot of species like robins, cardinals, grackles, crows, jays, they survive quite well in the suburbs. They have adapted. And even in my lifetime, a few species have managed to make the switch. Red-tailed hawk and wild turkey are two species that here in the Northeast were completely absent or pretty scarce in the 1970s when I was a kid, and now they're very common. They're in suburbs. They're both species are found have been found in Central Park in New York City, which would have been really shocking 50 years ago. So birds are the bright spot is that birds are constantly adapting, changing, shifting. They're so mobile, they can shift their migrations, shift their wintering range, their summer range. And I think a lot of species have increased over the last 50 years. So it's not all dark, depressing news about the environment with birds. There are a lot of species that are doing very well. And I think birds will outlast us on this planet. They will always find a way. There are species, there are a lot of species that need our help, a lot of species that need their habitat to be protected. That's one of the biggest challenges. But birds are so resilient and so adaptable that many species will continue to do just fine.
Well, that's great. That's very optimistic. So thanks, David. We've been talking to David Sibley, whose new book, What's It Like to Be a Bird? From Flying to Nesting, Eating to Singing, What Birds Are Doing and Why, is great because it's so accessible to us, people who watch birds, see birds, love birds, but don't know a lot about them. So I highly recommend it. And as most of you know, I have an independent bookstore, and the book it will be sitting on our front table. And we will really be excited about telling our customers about it. So thanks again, David. It's a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.
So today we were talking about a topic that many of us know superficially just because we see them flying every day, birds. David Allen Sibley, who's the nation's most renowned ornithologist, he's written field guides that are for professionals, but this book is for popular readers. And what it does is it tells us more about birds than we ever knew in a very accessible way. The book's called What It's Like to Be a Bird, From Flying to Nesting, Eating to Singing, What Birds Are Doing and Why. And it was an engaging conversation. I learned a lot, and I had many more questions that I could have asked, but we ran out of time. So please join us every week on The Avid Reader. We have some great guests coming up. Donald Hoffman will discuss his latest work, The Case Against Reality, Why Evolution Hid the Truth from Our Eyes. Another book about consciousness and reality. I think our third author in the past month has discussed the very topic in different ways. The next author after that will be Marie Musaki Mockett, who joins us to discuss her memoir, American Harvest, God, Country, and Farming in the Heartland. So join us. We'll see you next week here on The Avid Reader.